From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco, filling in for the vacationing Terry Gross. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet actor Michael Murphy. If you can't place the name, think back to all those Robert Altman films, MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville. Murphy also played one of Diane Keaton's lovers in Manhattan and starred as Jack Tanner, cable TV's long-shot parody presidential candidate. Also, pianist and singer Hatta Brooks joins us to perform a few songs. In the early days after World War II, she was part of the West Coast jazz rhythm and blues scene and has recently made a comeback. She tells us about those early days playing Boogie Woogie. And we have reviews of new rap albums from LL Cool J, Cool Mo D, and Boogie Down Productions, and of the new Brian De Palma film, Casualties of War. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. In Poland, President Wojciech Jaruzelski gave his approval for a plan to form a government led by non-communists. Jaruzelski met with Lech Wałęsa and the leaders of the two minor parties today, Jane Dobia reports.
Jaruzelski called for the creation of a government with the broadest possible social support that would represent all the political forces in the Polish parliament. That move seems to clear the way for a coalition headed by Solidarity. Yesterday, Lech Wałęsa said he would defer to other Solidarity leaders better suited to the post of prime minister. An aide to Wałęsa said several Solidarity candidates were submitted to Jaruzelski today. The president must present his choice for the new prime minister to the parliament. Jaruzelski said the government should be formed as quickly as possible. The new prime minister may be presented as early as tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The Communist Party in the Soviet Union today opened the possibility of radical changes in the Soviet Union's structure by offering new powers to the republics, possibly rewriting the agreement that united them. The party leadership offered the proposal in its exit solution to ethnic conflicts that threatened to rip apart the Soviet Union. More than 200 people have died in ethnic strife in the past 18 months, and groups in several of the 15 republics are calling for secession. Federal researchers found this afternoon the AIDS drug AZT can help people who are infected with the AIDS virus even if they have no symptoms of the disease. NPR's Michael Scholer has more.
Just 2 weeks ago, the National Institutes of Health announced that people with the very earliest symptoms of AIDS infection could benefit from AZT. Today, researchers said even people without symptoms may be able to postpone the day when they get sick from AIDS by starting drug treatment now. Health officials aren't saying everyone who is infected with the AIDS virus should be treated immediately. The government study so far only found a benefit for people whose infection was already impairing their immune systems. During the 2-year experiment, with AZT, these people were less likely to develop AIDS. Officials say over 400,000 people with no symptoms should now get AZT treatment. They had no word on whether the government would help pay for the expensive drug. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
Defense officials investigating the failure of the latest Trident II missile test say that engineers made a fundamental design error in the $26 million weapon. The head of the Navy's ballistic missile program, Rear Admiral Kenneth Malley, said the design engineers seriously underestimated the pressure placed on the missile as it is fired from a submerged submarine. The pressure affects the nozzle system, which helps guide the missile once it's out of the water. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 13 points to close at 2679.63. Declines led advances 8-5 on volume of 158 million shares. This is NPR News. The union representing most striking phone company workers and Bell Atlantic have reached a tentative agreement on key issues in their 12-day-old strike. The agreement was hammered out during formal negotiations in Washington, but the strike continues, and negotiations are set to continue tomorrow on less critical local issues. Labor and management are drawing battle lines in Las Vegas as seven other unions look to adding their support to striking musicians. Ann Harris of member station KNPR reports.
Four of the big five hotels met with representatives of the eight AFL-CIO-affiliated Las Vegas unions today. At issue was the solidarity of local union support for strip musicians ousted by three hotels and replaced with taped music. Culinary, bartenders, stagehand, and other service unions have a 90-day no-strike clause in their new contracts. That stipulation ends at the Tropicana on September 1st and shortly afterwards at the other resorts. Nevada AFL-CIO President Claude Blackie Evans says initial talks with the affected hotels have been unproductive.
We do have a legal right to honor the picket lines after a 90-day period. They indicated that they don't think we have that legal right, and that's a matter for the attorneys to resolve, I assume.
The eight unions will hold closed-door meetings this week to map out potential action against the Strip resorts. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Harris in Las Vegas.
Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani said today that Iran will work for the release of Western hostages in Lebanon if the U.S. adopts a more friendly stance toward the Islamic Republic. Rafsanjani made his comment to Pakistan's foreign minister after being sworn into office. Police in Colombia said today that gunmen on motorcycles shot dead a Bogota judge hours after he upheld an arrest warrant for a Medellin drug cartel leader. The killing threatens to spark a second national judges' strike this month. Appeals Court Judge Carlos Valencia was killed shortly after leaving his office last night. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Sedge Thompson sitting in for Terry Gross. He was Jill Clayburgh's errant husband in An Unmarried Woman, and he again was caught cheating on his wife in Woody Allen's Manhattan. My guest today is actor Michael Murphy. He's worked with many of today's leading directors. He played an ambassador in Salvador, a jackal of a reporter in The Year of Living Dangerously, and an anti-war activist in The Front. Murphy has also had a long association with director Robert Altman, dating back to the early 60s TV series Combat, and continuing with films including MASH, Nashville, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and last summer's cable TV series Tanner 88. Murphy had the starring role as a parody presidential candidate named Jack Tanner. The shows were shot during the presidential primary and combined staged footage and scenes with real candidates and people on the campaign trail. Murphy's new project is a film on HBO called Tailspin, about the political repercussions of the downing of Korean Airlines Flight 7. Murphy portrays Richard Burt, a senior State Department official who's caught in an internal White House power struggle over the incident. In this scene, Burt is talking with an aide who's trying to make sense of the news they're getting about the incident.
You know, you're being damn cool about all this, Rick. We may be talking about 300 dead here.
Listen, what do you think we're doing in that building, huh? I think we're supposed to jump off the roof the first time we hear a bang.
No, I'm not saying jump off the roof.
My job is to manage this crisis, not make it worse. Now maybe some of those European pacifists will begin to understand the nature of the beast we're dealing with here.
Jesus Christ. You mean, so you'll have a great hand to play with the Russians?
That's right. Listen, David, the only thing the goddamn Soviets understand is negotiate through strength. Years of work could be wiped out here. Listen, we let the crazies carry the ball on this. They're going to kick it right into World War III.
Some of these missiles don't even work.
So what? They don't have to unless there's a war.
Well, Michael Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Sedge.
This is a role for you that had you in the center of the action rather than playing an errant husband or a straight man to a Woody Allen. Is this the kind of role that you're gravitating toward nowadays?
Well, I'll tell you, the main interest that I had in this picture was really the picture. I can't say that it was the most challenging part I've ever played. You know, it was a part of a real ensemble. You know, I was trying to kind of evaporate into the film. I thought it had a lot of interesting things to say. I thought it was thought-provoking and... So probably nobody will watch it. But it was the subject matter that interested me the most. You know, it wasn't a big rock'em sock'em part. I was just a guy who was heavily involved in this thing.
Well, and the ultimate resolution of the story is that it turned out the American intelligence forces knew that the Russians had accidentally shot down the plane rather than intentionally, which had been the political line of the Reagan White House.
Exactly, yes.
Are political issues now necessary in scripts for you?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, the bottom line of all this stuff is, will it play, right? I mean, if you're out there making pronouncements, I think you get boring very quickly. But these kinds of pictures are interesting to do. You know, they do, as I said, provoke a little thought in terms of the audience. And I think that material's difficult to find nowadays. It's practically non-existent on network television.
Well, you were in a cable television series that ran during the 1988 campaign called Tanner, which probably did as well in the ratings as some of the candidates who dropped out of the wayside.
That's
which,
right.
which was odd because it was a splendid collaboration with Gary Trudeau, the cartoonist, doing the script, with Robert Altman, who also directed, and you played a presidential candidate.
Jack Tanner.
Named Jack Tanner.
It was a wonderful time in my life. I mean, I don't expect to find a part like that so soon again. It was just one of those magic situations, you know, where we were dealing with a home box office who stayed clear of us, and we would turn the. It was like working in television in 1947, I suppose. You know, you would. They gave you airtime. You turned in the show at the end of the month, and they put it on. And so it was running around the country with Bob Altman and Gary Trudeau making little Altman movies. You know, it couldn't have been better. So I found that, and I was certainly the title character. I was the guy in the suit, but it was an enormous collaboration. You know, it wasn't my show by any means. You know, and it just was. It couldn't have been better. Couldn't have been a better situation.
You played a presidential candidate who, in fact, as the campaigns went along, started mingling with the real candidates and
yes.
in real demonstrations and dealing with real issues. Were you comfortable with this as an actor using sort of Altman's two-thirds script, one-third improv?
Well, I have a long background, long association with Bob. We started together in the old combat shows in the 60s, you know, Vic Morrow and when they were blowing up the back lot at MGM. And so that was, I guess, 63, 64. And we've worked on and off together over this 25-year period. So I felt very comfortable doing it. It started quite... innocently, we were up in New Hampshire, and Jack Kemp was in the lobby giving a speech, and we would all wind up staying. We'd stay in the same hotels with all these candidates, and we were out on the trail. I remember we were in a hotel room one night and watching rushes, and Bob said, Kemp's down in the lobby. He said, get on your suit. Get your suit on. Let's go down there. And we were shooting everything with these little taped mini cams, and so people could drift in and out of the picture with cameras. It was all about the press, really. And so they just plunked me down next to Kemp, and we started talking, and then that whole idea was born that we should nail as many of these guys as we can. And then pretty soon they were calling us wanting to be on the show.
So uh-huh.
We would write scenes. And
well, there's a scene from Tanner that I think depicts this, but from the side of the press. You're at a Washington, D.C. cocktail party with a lot of the political pundits, some of the heavyweights, Mary McGrory, Sidney
yes.
Blumenthal, Hodding Carter. I'd like to hear how this scene played.
The reason that Dukakis is ahead, in my view, is not only because he is a candidate with a lot of money, it's because that his message that he brings is one that's similar to what the theme of this campaign could be if it were to win, which is he is somebody who's going to help America compete.
It's a great couch potato race, and you're going to have to make it into a real race.
It seems that so much so far has been abstract. We're talking about all kinds of controls, this and that, Gephardt. I mean, I think we've got to just start addressing people.
We're talking about this whole thing about issues, themes, and talking to the people. What are the technicians telling their candidates except Tanner and Jackson, maybe? What are they saying? What are the guys...
I wondered.
I don't know what I said there.
How did you guys do that scene without laughing?
It was really very interesting. Those guys really got into it. And I tell you, oddly enough, it was one of the most difficult scenes we did because you had real expertise in that room. And, they were all going for that camera and they all knew what they were talking about a lot more than I did. You know, there was a lot of esoteric information that went on.
Well, you did look very convincing
and
more convincing than a lot of the real candidates.
Well, thanks.
Which was frightening as a viewer.
Well, I was running around a bit with Bruce Babbitt at that point. He was gearing up to do a really interesting scene on our show where we walked along the Potomac and talked about what it was like to he just had dropped out, and he did a very interesting kind of wrenching scene about all that, and he looked at the scene we've just heard and he said, boy, it is exactly like those meetings in Washington. He said, just, you know, you sit there and you sort of wilt listening to all this advice. And this poor guy, I mean, he was such a wonderful guy and would have made a wonderful president. And he, you know, they had him going to charm school and all of that, you know, to polish his image. And it was all the things really he, I don't think, needed, but they laid a lot of showbiz on him, you know.
There's a line that you use in one of the shows. Being natural is one thing, but trying to appear that way is a contradiction in terms. It's what Daniel Boorstin alluded to in his book
as
the human pseudo-event.
That's right. Gary Trudeau.
Gary Trudeau came up with that.
Yeah, that was right out of the script, sure.
The script, I understand, would sometimes get handed to you no more than 10 minutes before a scene?
Yes, we were, as Bob said, we were joined at the hip with the fax machine. You know, we would be, and of course, events would change constantly. I was alluding to Mies a great deal in one episode, and then, we all know what happened to him, and I then had to change everything. I had to go in and loop lines and put everything in the past tense, and we were changing the stuff that we hadn't shot right, at the moment. So it was very interesting. I mean, events were changing so quickly. Scandals were happening right and left.
And you were creating some of your own in the
series. That's right.
My guest today is actor Michael Murphy. You've worked since 1963 on Combat with Robert Altman. You've been in Nashville. You've been in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You've been in the series Tanner. How have you seen him evolve as a director?
I can remember him in the early days coming in to, where there were very tight strictures. I mean, he was working for the networks, and he had to kind of deliver these shows. And even in those days, he was quite rebellious, and he'd get what he wanted to get, and he'd fight with the studios and carry on. And then, of course, he became quite famous, and I think some of that hurt him in a way. I mean, he got into an arena where he had a lot of people who were, yesing him too much, and he's a guy who loves to work, always has, And sometimes would go off kind of half-cocked on some of these films, with a lot of people telling him how fabulous he is, which he is. And now I think he's kind of come back around, and I think he's in a very good period in his life, and I think he's going to leave a wealth of wonderful work behind him.
There was a time when he was known for making the whole production a party. Everyone would sit down and take a look at the rushes together.
Mm-hmm. He still does that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And as an actor, do you feel more included that way?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a wonderful way to work. I mean, I've been so fortunate in my career being able to deal with people like Bob. I mean, I was spoiled at a very early age. He's the kind of guy who just, you're his good friend when you're working with him and when you're not working with him. And you would do anything for this guy on the screen as opposed to these kind of egomaniacal people who don't like actors to begin with. Bob does. And so when I would run into that kind of thing, it was very difficult for me because I had all this Altman kind of background.
You've worked with Woody Allen in The Front, and you played Yale, his friend, opposite him with Diane Keaton in Manhattan.
Right.
He has a reputation of being a very controlled and controlling director.
Yeah, it didn't happen that way with us. I first met Woody in The Front, in which he was acting. We were both acting. Marty Ritt directed the picture. And we became very good friends. And so by the time we did Manhattan, we knew each other so well and we'd acted together that there was never any of that feeling on the set. It was just like going to dinner together. I mean, it was very, very relaxed and easy and no tension. And, he would, I'd say, well, let's just wing a scene. Let's fool around with it. And he'd say, yeah, let's do it. We'd try it, and it wouldn't work, or it would, and it was very a very positive experience. I didn't have any of that business of not being able to read the rest of the script or any of that.
Uh-huh. My guest today on Fresh Air is the actor Michael Murphy. He played the errant husband in An Unmarried Woman and Woody Allen's friend Yale in Manhattan, and he's currently in an HBO special about the downing of the Korean Airlines Flight 7 in 1983 and the political events surrounding it. He's been directed by Robert Altman and Woody Allen in many of their films, and later this year he'll appear as a hard-boiled detective hunting down a killer. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm talking with actor Michael Murphy. In Manhattan, you play Woody Allen's best friend, a married man who's having an affair with Diane Keaton, with whom Woody has also fallen in love. And you've decided to leave your wife and to live with Diane Keaton. And Woody Allen seeks you out in the college where you're teaching English, and you're talking in front of a science classroom in front of a skeleton. I'd like to just refresh our memories of that scene.
What are you telling me? That you're going to leave Emily? Is this true? And run away with the winner of the Zelda Fitzgerald Emotional Maturity Award?
Look, I love her. I've always loved her.
What kind of crazy friend are you?
I'm a good friend. I introduced the two of you, remember?
Right. What was the point? I don't understand that.
Because I thought you liked her.
Yeah, I do like her. Now we both like her.
Yeah, well, I liked her first.
I liked her first? What are you, 6 years old? Jesus.
Look, I thought it was over. You know, I mean, would I have encouraged you to take her out if I still liked her?
So what, you liked her now? You don't like her? You did like her? You know, it's still early. You can change your mind one more time before dinner.
Don't get sarcastic about this. You think I like this?
How long were you going to see her without saying anything to me?
Don't turn this into one of your big moral issues.
You could have said, but you all you had to do was, you know, was call me and talk to me. You know, I'm very understanding. I'd have said no, but you'd have felt honest.
Brings back some memories.
Now, was this one of the scenes that you would work around and shape, or was this all fully?
It was a very interesting scene, to tell you the truth. We couldn't get it. Woody would write it, and then he didn't like it. And we did it in my apartment. We did it in his apartment. We did it in a restaurant. He came up with a gun. We tried all these different ways of doing it, and I don't know, maybe 3 weeks before the picture was released. We got together on a weekend and did it one last time at Hunter College. We'd been at Hunter 3 or 4 times. It was really one of those tough, and it was kind of resolved the picture in a way. So it was very important. We had to keep after it.
How would you deal with the issue of typecasting? For a long time, you always played very nice, neurotic,
quiche-eating guys. I know. I wouldn't work, you know, or I'd go off and do a play somewhere in the hinterlands. After An Unmarried Woman came out, I was offered every, you know, lousy husband part that came along, you know, always the guy. It spawned some of these so-called, I think kind of cynically called women's films, you know, that was probably the first where the woman was the heroine, and she always had some kind of awful husband or someone cheating on her or something. And generally this stuff would be devoid of any kind of subtlety, you know. So it didn't interest me. So it was a long time before I worked again. Really, I mean, I it was Woody's film. I guess I sat out about a year, and then I did Manhattan, and then it kind of started again. And so I would look for parts that were, you know, very different. I went off to New Zealand and made a couple of pictures that didn't work. One of which didn't get released. Another one, but I got to play, you know, tougher guys. But those are the chances you take. So the alternative is you don't work, you know, you sit it out and wait for something to come along that's going to change things, mm-hmm. because they're more than willing to keep you playing the same part all the time.
Your early career, actually probably for just a few short years while you were doing episodes of Combat and Dr. Kildare and Bonanza, was as an English teacher in Los Angeles.
Right, yes.
Do you regret leaving the school system?
In lots of ways. I enjoyed teaching, and I could see that I I scored some points with those kids. I was young, and I was interested, and I liked being in that classroom a lot. And from that point of view, yeah, I do. I miss it. There was something confining about it in terms of the administration, and you know, that door would slam on you, and you were in that room, and it was an era when, you know, here we were adults teaching school, and you weren't supposed to leave the school grounds for lunch, and I, you know, that kind of stuff rankled me after a while. I thought, here I am, you know, I'm out of school, and I don't want to be treated like a student.
Were you still teaching school when you played opposite Elvis Presley in 1967?
I had just stopped teaching school. Actually, I was. What happened? I was teaching in. And I ran into Bob Altman, whom I hadn't seen in a long time, and he said, "Oh, gee, you'd be great in this thing." And he was doing a television pilot, and so I did the show with him, and it was Carol O'Connor and myself and Andy Duggan, and it was a show that was, I said, years later they did Hill Street Blues. It was Hill Street Blues in 1965, I suppose, all shot at night and fast film and overlapping dialogue and everything, and of course it didn't go on. But it was kind of a it became a kind of celebrated cause, and I got some good agents and was able to get out of the classroom and get into this thing more full time. And then the first picture I did was with Elvis.
That was Double Trouble.
It sure was. Yes. Double Trouble. It was something too. There are lots of interesting stories about that too. I mean, apropos of Hollywood, but it was a remarkable experience to know that guy. And
you haven't seen him around lately, have you?
No, I haven't. I've been looking, but he was really something. I mean, I met him when he was at really the height of his career, and he was feeling good, and he was a lot of fun. You know, we were doing a lot of night shooting, and out on the back lot at MGM, and you get to know a guy at 4 o'clock in the morning. Nobody slept, and you know, it was many, many nights of sitting around talking, having a good time. I liked him a lot.
You've been in some television series that have worked in movies that have been extremely successful and well-regarded, and others that haven't, that have gone a couple of episodes and gone away.
That's right.
How do you handle the rejection that goes along when a series disappears? Do you just figure it's a gig and you move on, or is it a more personal feeling?
You have to. I mean, mm-hmm. you get used to it in a hurry. Television is very, very, it's hard to get too personal in television, because you look at anything I've done on network television, and both of the shows I did were you know, highly regarded scripts. But by the time they get done with them, and you realize that it's a very, very difficult medium. I mean, they're out there selling soap, and that's what it's about. You know, it's not. So I never took great pride in any of that stuff. I wish I had been able to. You know, on other arenas, you know, you're very. It's sad. I mean, when Tanner was over, I was at the Democratic Convention in Atlanta, and I was. As Gary said, it's like being at the center of the universe. I mean, I'd go out on that floor and thousands of people are screaming, "Tanner, Tanner," you know. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, this is great, but it's, in 2 days, it's all over. The series is canceled. It's finished. And I knew exactly what those candidates felt like, or those guys who were running, yeah, the candidates felt like, you know.
When you were making Tanner, did you ever feel at all tempted in any way to run for office?
Well, I could certainly see the appeal of it. I mean, it's a very heady trip. I certainly became much more interested in politics than I had been, and Jack was a guy whose sensibilities I was very comfortable with, and it was very odd because, you know, when we got to the convention. It was like DeBakey at a medical convention, I suppose. You know, here was a guy who, all these people were political junkies, and they all knew Tanner. And I was in this kind of elevated place for a while, and it was extraordinary, and it was fun. But there's a terrible downside to politics. I mean, if you could go in there and make some changes and do something. Worthwhile and do something for people. I don't think there's a better thing, but it's tough today. You know, it's a lot of corruption, and it's one business is worse than show business.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in and talking about your acting and your political career with us today.
Thank you.
Michael Murphy plays the Assistant Secretary of State for Soviet and European Affairs in HBO's new made-for-TV movie Tailspin, Behind the Korean Airliner Tragedy, which will debut this Sunday, August 20th. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with computer futurist Bill Joy. His computer designs and programs, especially through the company Sun Microsystems, have forced other major computer companies to move toward an era of interchangeable computer parts and software. His personal workstations are widely used in medicine, film, and engineering. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Coming up, the boogie-woogie queen of the 1940s West Coast jazz scene. We're hearing her now. Hatta Brooks has recently resumed working after a 16-year retirement, and she stops by to perform a few songs and to tell us about those early boogie-woogie days. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from the rappers LL Cool J, Cool Moe Dee, and Boogie Down Productions. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Casualties of War, a new movie from the director Brian De Palma, starring Sean Penn and Michael J. Fox. That's all coming up here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Sources say Polish President Wojciech Jaruzelski will choose a Solidarity member to be Poland's next prime minister. There are reportedly three Solidarity candidates that the coalition has offered, but Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa is not on the list. The White House reacted to Poland's movement from communist control, calling it a sensitive situation and one that it would be reluctant to get more directly involved with. Tom Verdi reports.
At the first briefing of President Bush's three-week retreat in Kennebunkport, Maine, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that while the administration was generally supportive of the process of pluralism in Poland, it did not wish to intrude in the internal affairs of the country to the point of choosing its form of government. Fitzwater did say, however, that a non-communist government in Poland would be a remarkable and history-making occurrence. He added that President Bush had not wanted to upset the apple cart during his recent visit to Poland, and that while he has discussed the situation with Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa, he is not willing to take an official position on the country's shifting politics. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Verdi reporting.
The Navy suspects a design flaw caused a Trident II missile to blow up during a test launch from a submarine earlier this week. But as NPR's David Malpas reports, the Navy says the failure should not delay the program.
Tuesday's test off the Florida coast was the second underwater launch to go awry. Only one sea launch of the big new missile has been successful. Officials believe both failures occurred when greater-than-expected water turbulence surged against the missile as it rose toward the surface. Further test launches have been postponed indefinitely, but officials say they still expect to deploy the Trident II missiles by next spring. Pentagon spokesman Fred Hoffman.
We still believe in the program, and we're still no reason to change our view of its importance or that it ultimately will be successful and hopefully on schedule.
The missile is expected to carry 8 warheads and be as accurate as the land-based MX. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Launch crews at Cape Canaveral are getting an unmanned Air Force Delta II rocket ready for blastoff early tomorrow. The launch is running 5 days behind schedule because of stormy weather. The rocket is scheduled to blast off at 1:50 a.m. Eastern Time. The Commerce Department reports a sharp decline in the nation's trade deficit in June. It says imports during the month were down nearly $2 billion. That placed the annual trade shortfall at a seasonally adjusted $8 billion, its lowest level in more than 4 years. The value of U.S. goods sold abroad in June is placed at $30 billion, breaking the previous record set in April. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 13.66 points today to close at 2679.63. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and rap critic Ken Tucker declares this the summer of rap music. Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing, is built around the Public Enemy song, Fight the Power. MTV's highest-rated show is Yo! MTV Raps. Prince, who used to badmouth rap music, now uses the style on his Batman album. And you know rap's hot when commercials use it to sell hamburgers and house paint. Today, Ken has the first of a two-part review of current rap records.
The past few weeks have seen a slew of new rap releases. The most immediate success has been LL Cool J's Walking with a Panther, which sold more than 2 million copies 2 weeks after it was released and is now firmly entrenched in the top five.
I'm the type of guy that picks her up from work early, takes her to breakfast, lunch, dinner, and breakfast. You're the type of guy eating a TV dinner, talking about, God damn it, I'm a killer. I'm the type of guy to make her say, why you illin' B? back is killing me. Catch my drift.
LL Cool J's I'm That Type of Guy is the sort of rap music that's most pervasive. The album is a collection of boasts and fantasies, with raps designed to tell you what a great, smart, handsome, sexy, strong type of guy LL Cool J is. After all, his name does stand for Ladies Love Cool James. I think one big reason LL Cool J is so popular is that he offers a cartoon version of rap, with lots of laughs and no menace. By the end of Walking with a Panther's generous 19 cuts, you're really wishing LL would come up with a subject other than himself. One rapper who stands in opposition to such ego rap is Kool Moe Dee, whose new release is called Knowledge is King. Of all the rappers, Kool Moe Dee is the most engagingly self-conscious. Instead of talking about himself, he likes to describe the way he creates his raps. He's entranced by the connection between work and art.
I go to work like an architect. I build a rhyme, sometimes it climbs so erect. Skyscrapers look like atoms, cause electrons rolling in patterns. Writing out word after word with each letter, it becomes visibly better. Cause my foundation built a nation of rappers. And after I came off vacation, I came to roam the land to own. Stand alone on the microphone, daddy's home. So open the door, playtime is over. Time to go to work, work to show the suckers in the place who run their face. A taste of the base, and who's the ace? Start the race. I'm coming in first. With these verse, I build a curse. So rappers can't capture Modi's rapture. And after I have to, I have to slap your senseless with endless rhyme. Don't pretend this is anything short of stupendous. And when this rhyme is done, your mind will become so trapped in the rap, you lust another one. But you gotta wait, it takes time. I don't write, I build a rhyme. Draw the plans, draft the diagrams. An architect in effect and it slams. And if it's weak when I'm done, renovate and build another one. I go work.
If you read the music press, it seems that Kool Moe Dee and LL Cool J have something of a feud going. LL, who just turned 21, thinks that Kool Moe Dee, a first-generation rapper who's at least in his late 30s, is a tiresome didactic drag. As you might expect, Kool Moe Dee thinks LL is a callow kid who needs to be taken down a peg or two. To me, Kool Moe Dee's deep, piercing voice is a lot more interesting in a music that does without melody, and I find his didacticism charming, even moving, on his album's earnest title cut.
Now who wants some? Come get it. A battle is a test of wits and I'm with it. Heartbeats, torch, and I lit it. Set the world on fire, I did it. Now that it feels good, I'm heating up. I feed off knowledge and can't eat enough. Cause knowledge is infinite, suckers ain't into it. Ignorance is bliss, and they're kin to it. They party and dance, and they don't ever glance at a book or look for their mind to advance. Caught in a rut. Chasing butt, trying to get a dollar or a nut. Evil feeds off a source of apathy. Weak in the mind, and of course you have to be less than a man, more like a thing. No knowledge or nothing. Knowledge is king.
Kool Moe Dee offers a lot of stay-in-school, get-smart messages in his compositions, but for relentless rap advice, he doesn't come close to the torrent of information offered by Boogie Down Productions on a new release called Ghetto Music, The Blueprint of Hip-Hop. Boogie Down Productions is the creation of a rapper and producer named Chris Parker, who uses the name KRS-One. This New York musician was one of the organizers behind last year's Stop the Violence campaign and charity record, and on a new song like World Peace, he combines lecturing with rap semiology to talk about his subject.
Yo, a lot of people are under the assumption that peace is soft for something. We must begin to reprogram our thought from how we were taught back in school and on our TV screens. Strength is always mean, love is always soft, and peace is too peaceful. We all are equal. Sit back and read the papers about the murderers, thieves, and rapists. We depend on police for justice. But when do we say enough is enough? Right now, and call their bluff. It's not a matter of fronting like you're tough. It's a matter of taking yours and living universal laws. Cause those laws cannot be bribed, nor changed, or paid on the side. You must come correct and walk straight. More love, less and less hate. When you walk,
KRS-One can be humorless and overbearing, but he can also be terrifically sensible. He recently said to Spin magazine, quote, "Whatever is a fad, that's what the kids will go for. The whole point of Boogie Down Productions is to make intelligence a fad." At his best, on a rap called Why Is That, KRS-One is posing pointed, timely questions that no one else is doing as well.
We're not here for glamour or fashion, but here's the question I'm asking. Why is it young black kids taught that? They're only taught how to read, write, and act. It's like teaching a dog to be a cat. You don't teach white kids to be black. Why is that? Is it because we're the minority? Will black kids follow me? Genesis chapter 11. Shem. Shem was a black man in Africa. If you repeat this fact, they can't laugh at you. Genesis 14, verse 13.
Boogie Down Productions. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. In the jazz and rhythm and blues scene that emerged in Los Angeles after World War II, pianist Hedda Brooks was known as the boogie-woogie queen. She liked to compose boogies inspired by her training as a classical musician. Here's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2 in Boogie. Brooks' career flourished, and she found herself playing the piano in Hollywood movies opposite Humphrey Bogart and Kirk Douglas. She was the first black entertainer to have her own weekly television variety show in Los Angeles. She retired in 1971, but was coaxed out of retirement a couple of years ago. This week, she's winding up an engagement at Michael's Pub in New York City. So we invited Miss Brooks down to Philadelphia to perform some ballads for us and talk about her career. Hedda Brooks.
Saying, is it so that your love is burning low? If this means we're really through, don't you think I ought to know? Dining at the club alone, I can feel the people stare. If this means, don't you think I ought to care? You know, darling, I always have such faith in you and the yarns we've spun. But like a fool, I live and learn that half a love is worse than none. If I can't have all of you, though I can't believe it's so, this means we're really through. Don't you think I ought to know? If this means we're through, don't you think I ought to know?
Hedda Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming down from New York, where you're currently playing, and bringing with you your bass player, Morris Edwards. I'd like to hear a couple more songs.
Good. Not much to look at, nothing to see, just glad I'm living and lucky to be. I've got that man crazy for me. He's funny that way. Can't save a dollar, can't save a cent. He'd never holler, I've paid the rent. I've got that man crazy for me. He's funny that way. Though he loves to work and slave for me every day, he'd be so much better off if I went away. Well, why should I leave him? Why should I go? He'd be unhappy without me, I know. I've got that man crazy for me. He's he's funny that way. Well, he's crazy. He's funny that way. Oh, but he's a man.
Hatta Brooks, here today with Morris Edwards Bass. You were trained as a classical pianist.
Yes, I was.
When you were growing up. And somehow you were introduced to the magic of boogie-woogie.
Oh, I was in the music store trying to get all the different rhythms out of the Poet and Peasant, which is a classical. And I was going into trying to get boogie. I had the waltz and I had the rhythm and blues as far as that was concerned, and a man was standing behind me and asked me, could I play boogie? And I said, well, I guess I can. And he says, well, you got a week to work one up and we'll record it. If something comes of it, we're in business.
And you had such a knack for it that you eventually became known at the time as the queen of boogie?
Yes. That's a monocle they put on me.
Is it a monocle you just assume not have?
That's a monocle I just assume not have.
But part of the boogie-woogie is having an extremely strong and heavy left hand playing through that, so much so that some people thought when they heard your records without you singing that you were a man playing.
Yes, they thought that. I went into Chicago on a record promotion, and the distributors were there, and my record people were with me, and I walked in, and the man looked up and said, where's Hatta Brooks? And he said, well, there she is. I said, oh, we thought she was a man. Her hand was so heavy.
Mm-hmm. You had a reputation of being a boogie-woogie player. How did you make the transition to singing?
Oh, I was very strong on the boogie, becoming very, very popular with the boogies. They were buying them. I obtained an engagement with Charlie Barnett at the Million Dollar Theater in Los Angeles. And he asked me what my repertoire was going to be, and I said, this boogie, that boogie, and if I get an encore, I'm going to do another boogie. And he said, why don't you break up the monotony? And I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, well, sing. I says, I can't. He said, well, fake it. And I did.
And by faking it, I mean you created a whole new career for yourself.
Never went back to boogie again.
Yeah. I'd like to hear your big hit that was the transition from being a boogie-woogie player into singing, called Trust in Me.
Okay. Trust in me and all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through as long as you trust in me. Come to me when things go wrong. Cling to me and I'll be strong. Can get along as long as you trust in me. While there's a moon on high, while there are birds that fly, while there is you and I, you can be sure. Face the future with a smile. Trust in me and I'll be worthy of you. Trust in me and I'll be worthy of you. Thank you.
Hatta Brooks with Morris Edwards in the piece that made her name as a ballad singer. Remember what year that was?
Late 48, 49.
Tell me a bit about But Not For Me.
Well, I'll let you listen to it. They're writing songs of love, but not for me. Our lucky stars above, but not for me. With love to lead the way, I find more clouds of gray than any Broadway play can guarantee. I was a fool to fall and get that way. High holeless and all it's all like a day. Still can't dismiss the memory of his kiss. I guess he's not for me.
Hatta Brooks with Morris Edwards bass. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Hatta Brooks is performing at Michael's Pub in New York through the weekend. A new collection of her recordings going back to the 40s called Hatta Brooks, Romance in the Dark is on Jukebox Lil Records. This is Fresh Air. Coming up here on National Public Radio is All Things Considered, and host Robert Siegel is here with a report on the usual comprehensive newscast. Robert?
Hello, Sedge. Today we're going to be reporting about the very remarkable developments in Warsaw, where Lech Wałęsa, the leader of Solidarity, it seems, will lead a government in coalition with two smaller parties that were for years aligned with the communists. It will be the first non-communist government in Eastern Europe since the years just after World War II. We'll hear what people there say and what some experts here have to say about it. Also, we'll hear from NPR's John Hockenberry about Lebanese refugees who are leaving Beirut and finding safety in the Israeli security zone of southern Lebanon.
Thank you, Robert. Another noteworthy All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With films like Carrie, Scarface, Dressed to Kill, and The Untouchables to his credit, Brian De Palma is one of Hollywood's most skillful and provocative directors. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of his latest movie, Casualties of War.
Like his friend Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma is eager to shed his oddly youthful image. He's not interested in making cult movies and zippy, scary pop classics anymore. Now he wants to make what he perceives as a larger moral statement. And moral statements don't come much heftier than the one Casualties of War delivers. The movie is based on an actual incident in 1966 that was reported by Daniel Lang in a New Yorker article. It's about Daniel Erickson, played by Michael J. Fox. He's a green private who finds himself on a mission in Vietnam during which an atrocity is committed. At the behest of the platoon sergeant, Tony Meserve, played by Sean Penn, a village girl is kidnapped from her hut. Then she's force-marched through the jungle, raped by every member of the five-man patrol except Erickson, and murdered. The movie is undeniably gripping. From David Rabe's impressive, if preachy, screenplay, De Palma has fashioned the tautest, most expertly told Vietnam picture to date. It's a nightmare film with a whooshing forward momentum and a sense of tragic inevitability that's almost overwhelming. It isn't as showy as some of De Palma's other pictures. His camera work is sinuous and deft, but it rarely takes center stage. And only in one sequence, in which Erickson is nearly blown to bits in the seeming safety of an infantry bathroom, does De Palma resort to his famous Hitchcockian suspense techniques. De Palma has set out to capture not just the physical horror, but the moral horror of what Vietnam was. And at that, he's succeeded. He uses Michael J. Fox's sitcom blandness as a kind of shorthand. We don't need to understand this boy's background or upbringing. He's the kid from the Great American Living Room. Put him in the NAM and you've dropped a virgin into hell. And De Palma has designed a peculiarly sensuous hell. Pythons glide silently across jungle trails. Filigreed temples loom on bombed-out horizons. And on a sunny day in a friendly village, the guy next to you may suddenly cut off his joke in mid-punchline because his neck and chest have just been lanced by 100 tiny bullets. All of which may help explain why Sergeant Meserve and his cronies lose their moral bearings. But it doesn't save the movie from its central flaw. Nothing in Casualties of War ever makes us doubt that Meserve is a villain, or that Erickson is a hero who will seek Meserve's punishment. The movie can't truly explore the moral decisions it intends to explore, because those decisions have already been made for us, even before we walk into the theater. Should soldiers rape and murder native girls? Of course not. And if they do, should they be brought to justice? Obviously. Those answers are so plain that it would require prodigies of psychological excavation to make the questions even interesting again. The enigma of why decent men commit evil deeds is quite another matter. But, oddly enough, Sean Penn's power and the way De Palma has directed him wipe that mystery off the screen. Despite his grotesquely sullen public image, Penn is still an extraordinarily skillful actor, and the tobacco-spitting hyper-macho he brings to his character is electrifying. But he and De Palma make Meserve an unequivocal monster, like Robert De Niro's Al Capone in The Untouchables, or Piper Laurie's Demon Mama in Carrie. The result is thunderbolt storytelling, but there's no room in it for moral ambiguity, the kind of moral ambiguity that might have made Casualties of War not just powerful, but profound.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Vablaitis, and Richard Parker. Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time, the 2001 computer, a phenomenally fast machine of 14 years hence, as imagined by Bill Joy, a computer whiz and founder of Sun Microsystems. Also the how and where of personal hygiene in the great outdoors with veteran river guide Kathleen Meyer. I'm Sedge Thompson. I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.